Hey, this is Lance Price. I'm here with my co-host, Matt Wellington. Today, we're interviewing our very first veterinarian, Dr. Matt Kuhn. Just to be clear, Dr. Kuhn is not the very first veterinarian ever. That person died a few thousand years ago. Matt is the very first on our show. Anyway, Matt is currently a AAAS fellow for the Department of Defense and holds both a PhD and a doctorate in veterinary medicine, which I believe makes him our first double doctor. What do you know? It's a show of first. First veterinarian, first double doctor, and it's our first double Matt episode. The two Matts and I will discuss some of the issues related to antibiotic use in food animal production and try to differentiate responsible use from routine industrial use. We really hope you enjoy the episode.
Well, thanks for that introduction, Lance, and I am really excited for today's episode of Superbugs Unplugged. Joining us today is Matt Kuhn, and he's going to give us a little bit more of his background. And Matt and I have interacted quite a bit. We've jousted very civilly on Twitter about antibiotic use on farms. And so I've always respected his feedback and his insight into the industry and the issues that we're working on. And he started listening to the podcast, so glad to have a fan out there. And he mentioned to me on Twitter, you know, you guys haven't really had any veterinarians on your podcast to talk about their perspectives on how to reduce antibiotic use. And so I said, well, Matt, this is your lucky day. And he was kind enough to join us. So thanks for hopping on with us, Matt.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm, you know, really excited to be here. I always love having dialogue and be able to find some common ground and, you know, talk with like-minded folks that kind of have similar goals that I have with antibiotic use. And so my background is that I'm a veterinarian. I mostly specialized in dairy medicine and dairy cattle. I also have a PhD in bovine immunology. So I kind of consider myself a scientist veterinarian, if you want to call it that. I'm currently a AAAS Science and Technology Policy Fellow. So I also like to dive into kind of the policy of things and understand somewhat holistically how we can bring science and policy together to really make effective changes and make effective changes.
Awesome. Before we jump into that, and I've got lots of questions for you, Matt, we need to cover the question that I think all of our listeners have been dying to get the answer on, and that is what Sydney Reese, our campaign associate, decided to name her cat. So Sydney's joining us, and she's going to chime in on our conversation here. But my God, Sydney, tell us. We all need to know. What did you end up naming your kitten?
Yeah, I think it's the question on everyone's mind at this point in time. We went with the name Bisquick. Yes, as in the pancake mix. Not sponsored, although Bisquick, if you'd like to sponsor this podcast, let us know.
Right.
Or my cat, for that matter. But yeah, thank you so much for having me back. And I hope you are all pleased with the naming choice we decided to go with.
I have got to say, I'm not pleased. And I've told you about this privately. I think it's too many syllables. Well, we should do a quick poll. Who's a dog person versus a cat person? Because I'm definitely in the dog camp. We know Sydney's in the cat camp. So what about you, Lance? I don't think we've talked about this.
I'm not really into animals that require me to pick up their poo. So I'm neither. But I do like the name. Is that a combination of busy and quick?
Maybe, but it's mostly named after the instant pancake mix, Bisquick, which is a store-bought pancake mix.
Yeah, I'm quite familiar with it. I'm just wondering why a cat would be named.
Oh, that I don't know. We just started calling her it, and she stopped climbing the screen for a total of 3 seconds, and we were like, we've done it. We've named her, and we never went back.
The other one was Miso, right? That was the other option?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would have gone with Miso. Rolls off the tongue. What about you, Matt? Cat person or a dog person? Or I guess a cow person or any of the other animals?
I definitely am a cow person. But as far as something I can keep inside my house, I definitely fall in the dog category. We have one dog right now. I'm sure soon to be many more in the future, but no cats.
Yeah, I was just realizing I've seen your dog on Twitter. He's a, or she's a... Geez, what kind of dog is it? I can't think of the name.
Oh, he's a pit bull.
Pit bull, yeah. Super cute.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of the dog Twitter, which I feel like it's jarring for people who follow me on Twitter because it's like COVID, antibiotic resistance, and then a picture of my dog tucked in on my couch with her head under the pillow. But you know, you gotta lift things up every now and then. Well, so let's jump in and talk about antibiotics. So Matt, I know you just described your background a little bit for us. Can you tell us more about how you got into thinking of and, you know, discussing antibiotic resistance? And I know we've you know, had a lot of discussions via Twitter, but yeah, how did you get into it and what made you so passionate about antibiotic resistance?
You know, Twitter was actually kind of one of the real driving factors that it didn't start my interest, but it really got it going. So the lab I joined in graduate school was really focused on understanding why cows get sick at certain times of their lives, with the goal of, if we can understand why they get sick, then we can prevent it instead of using antibiotics to treat a subsequent infection. So I was kind of joined into the conversation by being in a lab that was trying to reduce antibiotic use in general. But then, you know, once I started to get involved and started having conversations, I think I somewhat got a little emotionally attached to it, if you want to call it that. We all see that there's the finger pointing from vet med to physicians and physicians to vet med. And that really always bothered me, that I saw too much kind of blame going around. And I felt like I needed to kind of normalize that we have a problem and normalize that, you know, it's okay that physicians have a problem and for them to say they have a problem and focus on it. It's okay for veterinarians to say we have an issue with antibiotic misuse and that we're, you know, we're trying to help that, but it's an issue. And so I always tried to find common ground with folks and not say, you know, you don't have to blame us. We don't have to blame you. We can help each other to try to come find some common ground and then find ways that we can, you know, help each other to reduce use or be more responsible with our antibiotic use.
Yeah, I think that's a great point about the finger pointing. And yeah, that's one of the things I find refreshing about talking to you, is that you're not immediately on the defensive in a way that I think a lot of folks in the industry tend to be, at least in my discussions with them. So why do you think that it, like, what can we do to make that more of the dialogue with veterinarians? Because I think, you know, again, at least in my experience, it goes immediately to the finger pointing. And, you know, why would you talk about antibiotic use in veterinary medicine when so much more of the misuse is happening in healthcare settings? And I don't know, Lance, if you, well, I think you have had similar experiences, but why don't you tell us? And then, you know, yeah, how can we change that?
Well, I've heard it from both directions, as Matt was indicating. You know, when we push the docs, you know, for instance, you know, working on urgent care, and you know, they'll want to immediately point fingers at animal production when it's clear that there's an overuse problem in urgent care. And so, and then, you know, when you push on the vet community, they want to point at the doc community. And meanwhile, I'm pointing fingers at everybody except myself. So I think, yeah, I mean, I think it's probably human nature, but it's rampant out there. And so moving past it would be great. And the one thing that I was probably not as good at this when I first started, because I was really focused on the animal use side, is that I think every talk now that I give, every time I talk about this issue, I talk about this being an ecological problem, and that the overuse in animals and the overuse in people, they work synergistically to fuel this problem. And so I hope, and I try to start with that and end with that, to hopefully get people to sort of back off of whatever edge they're on.
Yeah.
One of the ways we can, you know, start to have a dialogue more and reduce some finger pointing is to try to humanize it more and remember that, you know, when we're discussing the other side, if you want to put it that way, they're not a, you know, it's not a block of folks all making decisions together and all, you know, out to get anyone. It's, you know, a physician sitting down with a mom and their daughter that has a stuffy nose and, you know, just having the worst day of the year, and they have to decide what they're going to do. And it's a veterinarian going to a farmer's ranch maybe, you know, they've got a sick cow that they don't know if it's viral or bacterial, but they've got, they drove an hour to get there and they've got to do something. And I think, you know, we have to remember that all the decisions that come around antibiotics come down to a single person making a decision. And if we can humanize it a little bit, you know, we can kind of keep the dialogue going and remember that no one's out to get anyone. No one's purposefully making bad decisions. It's just humans being humans and, you know, trying to many times take care of their clients, their patients, to the best of their ability.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Matt. But I think there are also sort of industry level decisions that are being made both in human medicine and animal production that that drive overuse as well. You know, so if you think about in human medicine, insurance companies, you know, paying flat rates to, you know, to outpatient clinics for a patient visit. So they get a flat rate for that visit. So that doesn't leave room for, or that creates a disincentive for the use of a rapid diagnostic test or something that could inform better antibiotic use, you know, and, you know, could encourage the use of very cheap, you know, quick prescriptions to expedite visits. And then, you know, the decisions that are made, you know, I've seen it as my family, you know, owns a cattle ranch in Texas. And so as a child, I was around this. I know that we made decisions about giving animals antibiotics. But there's also industry level decisions that are being made as far as, you know, feed formulations and the reasons for adding antibiotics. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think to a certain extent, certainly there are drivers. I guess what I was getting at is that there's no one block. There's no, you know, there's not a animal agriculture industry is not a single community. It is, but there are different aspects of it that all have different issues that we need to address. To your point with the feed additives, you know, we see that as an issue much more on the many times beef, maybe swine side than we do dairy poultry. And so it's, you know, it's important to remember who we're talking about and not clump, just like, as you mentioned with human med, that it's not great to just say physicians in general. We should remember that, you know, emergency docs are facing their own challenges, whereas outpatient docs are facing different challenges. And each of these have layers that we need to peel back to try to come up with solutions for each of them individually.
I couldn't agree more, actually. I mean, I think that the only way we make progress on this is to think about the ecosystems that each of these, you know, like, you know, doctors or veterinarians or whoever is working within, and their patients, whether they be chickens, pigs, or cattle, or people, and then to understand the pressures that they're under, right? So if they're, you know, a doc working in urgent care has different set of pressures than, you know, a nurse practitioner working in a CVS Minute Clinic, you know, and I think that a veterinarian working for, you know, Purdue Farms or, you know, one of the other big producers has a, you know, working in chickens, or working in pigs has a totally different set of pressures.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So, yeah, go ahead, Cindy.
Sorry, yeah, I'm listening to this from a communication perspective and when tackling kind of these blocks, whether it be in human or agricultural medicine, you know, how do we as communicators divide up an already complex issue even further for those to understand who, you know, they didn't go to med school and they're hearing about antibiotic resistance for the first time, because certainly don't want to be a problem of the finger pointing at all. But it's already such a complicated issue. And a lot of times the easiest way to get your point across is just to lump everyone into one category. So I guess, Matt, do you have any recommendations for the people who are trying to talk to the general public about this issue and how they can break it up even further to truly find the root cause of some of these problems?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And to be honest, I don't know if I do. I think communication is one of the most difficult issues we face, especially to the public, like to, almost exactly to your point, it is such a complex issue that we already struggle to get a fair and educational, you know, rubric out there to people so they know how to make purchasing decisions and, you know, how to either, whether it's cook their food or what to do with their antibiotics and their prescribed, that to really get into the nitty gritty of it and be fair to everyone is impossible. I don't know if I have a good answer for you there.
Yeah, I mean, the way that I think about it, and I agree, it's a great point, is that, you know, as advocates working to pass policy, sometimes we just have to be comfortable with pointing the finger at some folks a little bit more than others. And I try as much as possible to base that on the data, right? And when we look at the data, and I think you even said this before, Matt, it's a whole different ballgame with antibiotic use when you look at the cattle industry, so the beef industry, and the pork industry versus poultry and dairy. And so I feel like it's helpful to just base it right from there. So we know that the most antibiotics out of the meat production industry are sold to beef cattle in particular. It's like 42% or something like that out of the whole mix. And we also know that in the conventional industry, there are just parts of the process that we don't need to use antibiotics, you know, whether it's for liver abscesses from the poor diets or from, you know, the respiratory disease when they're shipped across the country. Like, there are ways to figure out better solutions that don't rely on preventative use of antibiotics in the same kind of way as what you and your lab, it sounds like, we're trying to do for dairy. So that's how I kind of approach it, is that I think we can break it down simply enough for the public to get on board with it, but we might just have to be kind of comfortable with pointing our finger at some groups more than others based on the data.
I think that I know this is might be one of the spots where we don't necessarily always see eye to eye, which is fine. You know, obviously there's no question that the beef and pork sectors use more antibiotics than the other sectors of antibiotic culture. We know that from the sales and use data. But I think it's the issue of overuse or misuse goes very far beyond, you know, simple changes to how we use antibiotics or when we use them. You know, when you are using them metaphylactically or prophylactically, however you want to phrase it, for cattle that have been shipped to a feedlot, you know, to get rid of the need there for those cattle, you almost have to completely change the entire fabric of the cattle industry. We have thousands of cow-calf operations across the U.S. And then, you know, the current makeup of the feedlot or the finishing areas is that they're quite large. And so it's almost impossible to, in our current state, to not transport cattle long distances and you know, commingle them, which we know increases the risk of getting bovine respiratory disease and needing those antibiotics. So I think there are definitely feedlots that are doing a better job of getting cattle that are preconditioned and lower risk, so they don't need to use that metaphylaxis. But I think that's one of the areas I struggle with. I think a lot of veterinarians do, because we obviously know that's an issue. You know, we don't like to see calves coming to a feedlot that are high risk, but it's so ingrained in just the geographic setup almost of the cattle industry that there's no great way to change that, other than, I'll say, you know, obviously pushing preconditioning, pushing vaccinations is something we always try to do. Same thing in human med and every other sector of veterinary medicine, but trying to convince producers that that's worth it to them, you know, that can be a struggle.
You know, I actually think we see more eye to eye on this point than you would think, because I totally agree. Like, it, from what I'm getting from what you're saying, is that it's not an easy fix in the cattle industry, right? Whereas it was an easier fix in the poultry industry. The chicken industry was able to eliminate antibiotic misuse by doing, you know, some what I would think are common sense management changes, but it's just structured so differently from the cattle industry, like you said. So when we talk about changing antibiotic use in the beef industry, part of our messaging is, and I think maybe even needs to be more about the structural changes that we need to take place. Cause I can, you know, see a veterinarian's perspective thinking, we have to use antibiotics in this way, because the way the system is set up, if we don't, the animals will get sick on such a larger scale. And that's your responsibility, is to keep those animals healthy, right? So I totally get that. And so I think we should just maybe even push more in our public messaging for people that we really should rethink how we raise cattle in this country, because if it's relying on preventative antibiotics to keep the animals from getting sick, then that's a flawed system. And so let's tackle that. It's not going to be easy. It's not going to be quick, but let's start to do it. And then that ends my tangent on that front. And I'm curious what Lance and Sydney think about this point.
Well, I just don't think we should let turkey off the hook. So if you actually adjust per, you know, milligram of antibiotics per pound of meat produced, turkey is just as bad as beef and pork. The real outlier here is chicken. And I think the progress there has come through very strategic finger pointing, you know, if you look at it, right? So it's been community outreach, education, and then a lot of, I think, the retail work that, you know, like antibiotics off the menu has been working on, where you point to companies that don't have solid policies, and first you try to have conversations with them to convince them to adopt policies for responsible antibiotic use. And if they don't, then you publicly point your finger. And so I don't want to move away completely from pointing fingers, but I don't think we should just point our finger at the entire industry.
Yeah, I think on the structural change front, I say, why not? You know, why not structural change? And I agree with everyone, it's not going to be easy, but we know that there are tangible solutions that other nations have taken, and even states in the United States have taken towards these structural changes for the meat industry. And it always strikes me when I'm on calls with coalition members and legislators, how many taxpayer dollars are going to cleaning up the industry's mess. And I think that's something that we have to recognize and have to make change on.
Yeah, let's work that into our messaging. Why not? Why not? To get back to some of the experience you've got, Matt, you talked about the dairy lab. Dairy has been kind of an enigma to me over the last several years. Like I've looked into it a little bit, and we were working on some legislation in New York on antibiotics, and dairy, of course, came up a lot because the industry there is pretty active. And I think, you know, those were some really interesting discussions to have. And I actually noticed that there was a difference between what folks on the ground in New York and like what the New York Veterinary Association or whatever the trade group was for New York State had a different view of what we were doing than the national AVMA, the Veterinary Medical Association nationally. And so it was interesting to see all of that play out. But can you just tell us a little bit more about your experience in that lab, which you said is, you know, the purpose was to find ways to reduce antibiotic use. So how did that all play out? What did you guys find?
Yeah. So, I mean, our research is it's a continually ongoing baby steps forward. But we've definitely, you know, we're coming up with different ways that we're understanding how the immune system works in cattle. And it's things that we're just now learning in humans. We're about 5 years behind, you know, trying to catch up and really understand what is driving, what drives disease. You know, why do cows get sick at certain times? And I think the dairy industry is really interesting. I think they have been very proactive about antibiotics for one. I think part of it is that we didn't use a ton to begin with. So starting to really focus on how to use them judiciously was a tangible target that we could go after. I think dairy use of antibiotics makes up less than 1%, maybe, or 1% of the overall use. And even then, I think between the 2017 and 2018 FDA data, it went down 20% or something. And a lot of that is probably due to a reduction in intramammary therapy at dry off. So when cows stop milking, used to be fairly standard practice to add an antibiotic to their teats because it was common to get mastitis or an infection of the mammary gland at that time. And we've gotten much better at kind of teaching farmers how to almost do microbiology on the farm. So a lot of farmers will have their own incubators and will, you know, grow their own infections essentially, and see, you know, what kind of bug do I have here? Is it a bug that I can treat with an antibiotic? Is it an infection that isn't going to respond anyways? And then how can we make better decisions of which is the best antibiotic to use? So I think there we've had a mix of really good research decreasing infections through really good nutrition, as well as good outreach and extension of teaching our farmers how to not only use antibiotics when they're necessary, but when they do, to always make the best choice as well, so that they're not having recurring infections and they're really hitting the mark on the first time.
That is super cool. So you're telling me the farmers are, you said that they're actually doing the background microbiology work to figure out which antibiotic would work for an infection. Is that what you were saying?
Yeah. So the way, I mean, so it's very broad, the way that they're kind of deciding on them, but essentially with a, if you order some culture plates just from a commercial distributor and you have just a chicken incubator, most of those can get warm enough to grow bacteria. So you can take, for example, a milk sample, squeak it on the blood agar, give it 24, 48 hours. And then depending on how deep into it you want to dive, you can see, is this gram negative, in which case we typically don't treat, or is this gram positive, in which case we're probably going to try to treat with an antibiotic, or is there no growth at all? In which case, you know, again, it's not going to be worth growing, or treating, excuse me. And then in other cases, some can go a little farther and add, certain little drops that companies sell to get different reactions out of the bacteria to try to hone in even more on what specific maybe genus that they have if they can't get down to the species.
Yeah, I have questions about this gram negative, gram positive thing, but what does our resident microbiologist think about this microbiology on the farm?
I think it's good to get a culture before you treat. I think I'm happy to hear that that's happening. And, you know, I wish more doctors would do that with patients, actually, instead of guessing at what people are infected with and treating them. So, yeah, it's good. And so with the gram positive, gram negative, you know, so basically with the gram positive, you're treating because it might be staph, and staph can lead to, well, from mastitis to more serious infections?
So we're treating gram positive because we have good antibiotics to treat it, essentially, when it comes to intramammary. So we only have actually in dairy very few antibiotics that you can use, obviously, because these are milking animals that are contributing to the food supply. And so even though their milk is discarded after they've been treated for a set amount of time, we're still very limited by the FDA on which antibiotics we can use. So we have decent antibiotics to treat gram-positive infections of staphs, but the gram-negatives, typically either the animals are going to clear the infection by the time that we could get an antibiotic to them, or, you know, we don't have a lot of intramammary antibiotics that are great to use. Those are the ones, though, that we end up using a lot of systemic antibiotics on, because unfortunately gram-negatives can get really nasty and go systemic. In which case, then we have to turn to our systemic antibiotics to try to get ahead of those.
This is fun for me because like Matt, like the other Matt, Welly, I don't think about dairy as much, but I was reading some about the history of antibiotic use in animal production, and some of the first calls to reduce antibiotic use in animals, like 1940s, was because there were so many antibiotics in the milk that it was killing cheese cultures. And so they couldn't make cheese because there were so much antibiotics in there. And so, I just think it's interesting. Yeah.
Well, so Matt, what do you think dairy producers, because it sounds like, you know, you're conscious of trying to reduce antibiotic use, you're taking these concrete steps. What can the beef industry learn from you guys being dairy industry? Because I don't know of this kind of thing happening in the beef industry, you know, culturing infections, and maybe that's just my own ignorance, but what do you think of that? Like, where are the lessons that you think dairy producers can teach beef producers? Here's how we figured out how to, and I know it might be just comparing apples to oranges or whatever, but if you can find parallels, what do you think they would be?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest issue that they face, obviously, is the scale. Typically, when dairies are dealing with infections, it's single animals here and there. You know, they might have an outbreak here and there of something that they have to do, maybe an in-feed. It's more rare. I think one place that they can really maybe help beef out or learn is the emphasis that dairy places on vaccines. There are certainly producers in beef that are fantastic about preconditioning and give the entire, you know, this is the vaccines, everything that they can have. They wait until animals are older to get them to a feedlot, so they really reduce the risk of bovine respiratory disease. But I think the emphasis that dairy puts on it is really, really strong. And the emphasis on, you know, managing animals to the absolute best of their ability to prevent infections is really strong. I think partly because we don't have many treatment options, and because animals stay in the dairy herd much longer. So the loss of a single animal in dairy is far more significant than it might be in beef, because, you know, that 2-year-old cow that just had her first calf, she could have gone on to have 6 or 7 more calves for you and really been a valuable asset to your farm. So there's a huge incentive in dairy to take care of your animals for the long term. That I don't know if is necessarily quite there yet in beef. I think there are definitely operations that are getting there, and we've seen more of the kind of grass-fed or organic side try to be doing that more, or smaller beef producers that are kind of doing guerrilla marketing or their side marketing that are really pushing that. I think that's great.
So this, again, seems like a structural issue, right? Because you have the independent cow-calf operation. So that's where the cattle are grazing out in the field before they're loaded up into these trucks and shipped to the feedlot, right? And those are often independent producers who don't see the disease that they see at the feedlot and might not have that incentive to use those vaccines at that point. Right. And it's only after they're loaded up into the truck, shipped, that they get the shipping fever, a production disease that leads to antibiotic use. And then on the feedlot, where they're switching from grass, which, you know, they're evolved to eat, to eating, you know, these rich diets of corn and soybean, that they start to get the liver abscesses, another production disease that leads to a lot of antibiotic use. And so, you know, it's that structure could disincentivize, you know, the use of vaccines. And so it puts the pressure on the feedlots then to experiment with alternative ways to, you know, prevent these infections. I wonder if any research is going into, you know, alternative feed formulations to prevent liver abscesses, for instance.
Yeah, so I can tell you from the animal literature, that research is constant. You know, they really are pushing as many forages into these animals as they can and still maintain the growth rate and the musculature building and fat building that their buyers expect. So, you know, a lot of beef comes down to money, unfortunately, and there's only so much of it. Margins are thin. You have contracts you have to meet. And I think that's part of the reason we see these backgrounders and the cow-calf folks maybe not always doing as much, is because it's not in their financial interest. You know, that's a lot of handling of their animals and labor to go through all the preconditioning, because a lot of vaccines aren't just one time, it's several, and they have a cost to them. And so you have to be compensated for that, which means the feedlots have to also then be compensated for that. And so I think we need, to your point of structural change, part of it is economics of someone at the consumer end needs to pay a little bit more, and then that money has to find its way all the way back to the day that calf is born. And I'm not an economist by any means, but I'm not so sure that that's always happening, that we're seeing the money trickle down all the way and make it worth it for these kind of first step folks to you know, be incentivized to do these things for the cattle.
Yeah, I mean, for me, that's an argument for policy, though. So you have, you know, you equal the playing field. Of course, that doesn't help for international competition, but within the United States, then you don't have this disincentive for doing those kinds of documents. But when I was a kid, I have to say the most fun I had was when we put the cattle into the squeeze chute and we gave them vaccines or whatever we did with them in the squeeze chute. That was kind of fun. Otherwise, we were just like throwing them hay in the wintertime and then going out and counting them.
Did you ever go on the squeeze chute, Lance?
I have. I've been in the squeeze chute. It's usually covered in cow poo, though.
Wow. So I just wanted to chime in with a layperson's question. So Matt, when you say they're putting as much forage as, I think you use plural, forages into these animals, that's food, right? You just mean food.
No, sorry. Grasses. We typically talk about forages and concentrates are the hot part of the ration or the energy part of the ration. So the corn, basically corn soy, and then you have the forages, which are the different grasses that you're adding in. So, you know, you have to have enough energy to build up the meat as, you know, at the rate that you need to get the cattle off the ranch on a certain time. But then they're really pumping as much forage into that because the forage is what's going to reduce the chances of forming liver abscesses or anything like that. So they really are pushing forage as much as they can. But yeah, that's a very active area of research right now, certainly.
Yeah. Cow salad is another cow way you salad. Can think about it, Matt Wellington.
Perfect.
Yeah, that's a good way to think about it. So let's talk about consumers, because like you said, I mean, producers and farmers, they need to know that changing these practices, which won't be easy and will be sometimes more expensive, will pay off for them. And our position, I'll say, has always been, we think people should really be willing to pay a little bit more for a burger if that means keeping the foundations of modern medicine effective. Consumers, we know from the work we've done, people, they gravitate to this issue. We saw what consumer demand can do when it came to chicken and the chicken industry. Beef has been a harder one, and I don't think it's necessarily that consumers don't want to see this. But I'm curious what else you think we can do to reach consumers with the message that, you know, you might have to pay a little bit more, but here's why that's so important and we should make that choice. You know, if you're going to pay 50 cents more or a dollar more for a steak, here's what you're getting out of it. How do you think we can reach them?
I think part of it is with, you know, with honest labeling. So we have the folks that have no antibiotics ever, which I think we agree that when animals need antibiotics, they need antibiotics. And that shouldn't be necessarily a question to treat a active infection. So I think coming up with standardized ways to be clear about, you know, if there is a group or a food chain or a company selling a product that, you know, has a very specific antibiotic plan that promotes judicious use very strictly, that they can put that out there. So for example, USDA organic is a protected label that is, you know, very clear to consumers on what they're getting. And I think we need more things like that, that are widespread, agreed upon designations that people can learn about and then trust when they see it go from brand to brand to brand. I think it gets confusing when you have natural and grass-fed and all natural and no antibiotics ever, and all these different things that can be really confusing to consumers at times. Some obviously much more than others, but I always think standardization with something like that is really helpful. And if we could come up with a national plan, maybe that is USDA audited, that could be really helpful. Or for example, out of the University of Wisconsin, they have a thing called Food Armor, which is essentially a way that veterinarians become more involved with record keeping of antibiotics used on a farm. And, you know, you can become a Food Armor certified farm and put that on the labeling of your food. And I think it's mostly a local thing for now, but if something like that could go more mainstream, I think that would really incentivize people to maybe pay a little more to really know that what they're getting is following certain standards and audited to follow certain standards.
Yeah, that audited part is really key, I think, right? Because it's so easy for companies to just make these claims that either mean nothing at all or that are just not third-party verified. And Sydney, you actually just did some research on labels. What did you find? And this was for turkey, but I think probably same problems all over the industry. So What did you see when you were looking into that?
Yeah, first of all, I couldn't agree more. Having clear and standardized labels is going to be a huge push for consumer education and then helping consumers make the right choices. Because all over the place, you see no antibiotics or antibiotic-free meat, none of which are verified and most of which are misleading. So I think, yeah, USDA Organic is a great model that we should be following. No antibiotics ever is gaining speed and cropping up all over the industry. But I would take it a step further and say that grocery stores should be helping us in this endeavor and placing clear signage near their meat counters, right? What do these labels mean? What labels can people look for in order to make these educated decisions? Because all of the education we can do is not helpful if people get to the meat counter and are instantly confused. So that would be my biggest recommendation.
Yeah.
This is Lance. I have to say that I think that while I appreciate the simplicity of no antibiotics ever, and it certainly is working in chicken production, I do think that with cattle and maybe even with pork, that certified responsible antibiotic use, like the label that we run at the center, I think it's probably necessary to bring more producers on board, especially of those large, expensive animals that live a long time. You know, you could have, I think Laura says it, Laura, my colleague at the Antibiotic Resistance Action Center, says, you know, good animals get sick. And so, you know, you can raise them right for almost their entire lives and they could get an infection. And as soon as you use that antibiotic, you can no longer have that sort of value added label. And so a third party verification is essential, and coming up with, you know, working together with veterinarians and producers and public health people on what is responsible use, I think that's the future where we get more of these large animal producers on board.
Yeah, and I just want to be super clear as well that we're on the same page, you know, from PERG's standpoint. Obviously, we say the less antibiotics, the better for antibiotic resistance and, you know, a human health standpoint. But our official position is and has always been, if an animal is sick and they're diagnosed with an illness by a veterinarian, they should be treated with antibiotics to get them better. So I think that's something all three, you know, all four of us agree on. And, you know, when we see the no antibiotics ever labels, we'll tell consumers, you know, that that is good in terms of antibiotic use and here's what that means. But when we approach producers and restaurants, our official ask of them is that they follow something more in line with the certified responsible antibiotic use, which allows those, you know, necessary uses if an animal gets sick. So, yeah, I think we're all in agreement on that one.
Well, and this is Matt Kuhn from the veterinary perspective. Honestly, the no antibiotics ever moniker scares me quite a bit. I get from poultry that, you know, that's a different industry. That's kind of a different consideration. But when it's applied to different fields, the last thing I ever want to have happen is an animal get sick and then a farmer have to make a decision of, do I want to treat this animal because I'm going to lose out on a certain amount of money? And do we need to cull this animal early? Or, you know, hope that they get over this infection. I mean, that's the last thing that we ever want to see happen. So I appreciate the, you know, certified responsible use and at least still giving farmers that option that, yeah, you know, we don't want to have to think too long about when an animal is sick, treating them and not raising any animal welfare concerns.
Yeah, and I know, Lance, that the CRAW, if you will, that's how you say that acronym, right? CRAW, Certified Responsible Antibiotic Use.
Yeah,
good stuff. It's better than PERG. But the I think you recently came out with a CRAW standard specifically for beef. And what have the challenges been like for when you all are, you know, shopping that around to companies and producers to adopt? What have some of the challenges been like there?
So this is my turn to say I'm going to punt on this one because Laura does all that work and I can't speak to it right now. But I want to Can I address something else?
No, absolutely not.
So Matt, I think that's a really important point. I do think, you know, none of us want, you know, an animal that's sick not getting treated, right? What Matt and Sydney and I and many of us in our field are pushing for is changes to the system so fewer animals get sick, right? And I think that's what you're pushing for too. That I think there's a far cry from, you know, that cow calf operation with that, you know, one sick animal and you know, struggling with that individual animal decision. There's a far cry from that, from, you know, like, we know that the way that we're feeding these animals on the feedlot is giving them liver abscesses, so we're going to treat them all with this drug. Or we know that these animals were shipped this far, so we're going to have to treat them with antibiotics. I mean, there are these structural issues that lead to production diseases. And then there are issues with labeling that lead to disincentives for treating animals. And so I think we have to fix both of those things.
Yeah, and I just would say this is a good opportunity to cut through some of the other stuff that we see all the time. You know, like you said, Matt, the industry on the animal side is not, you know, you can't lump everybody together. And I've said before, I don't think everybody in the meat production, you know, system sees the kind of nuance that you do and is able to navigate that appropriately. So just to be very clear for everybody listening, if you work in the food animal production industry, we absolutely think animals should be treated if they're sick. We also know that there are no antibiotics in the actual meat itself when consumers buy it. We understand that there are processes to stop that from happening, but that's not what we're concerned about. We're concerned that the overuse of antibiotics on the farms when their animals are raised will breed drug-resistant bacteria that can travel off the farm and make us sick. So those are just some of the two most infamous arguments we get from folks in the industry about why we should not be reducing antibiotic use. And I'm not saying, Matt, that's your view. I don't think it is, but I always take that opportunity to cut through some of the BS because I think we actually agree on a lot more than we think.
Yeah, and I think the issue with folks assuming others think that there's antibiotics in their meat, I think that's really a kind of a historical thing that we did fight for many years. And now we've kind of moved past it. I don't think it's really the existential threat that we think it is anymore, but it became so ingrained in so many folks in the industry that this is something we had to educate people on, that, you know, it was just something that we continue to be at the forefront of our minds and always came to mind when we start having these conversations.
So Matt, this has been really interesting and helpful to have you on here. I have definitely appreciated it. I'm sure Lance and Sydney have as well. So to send us out for our listeners out there for Superbugs Unplugged, which by the way, are international. We just found out we have an international audience. What's the last thing you would want to say to folks who are listening about, you know, antibiotic use and veterinarians and how we can make things better?
Yeah, I think it's that we, you know, we understand that there's a problem. And as individuals, many of us in the veterinary community are trying to make change, but a lot of these changes need to be big. And so it's a lot of vets making small changes here and there that really are trying their best to, you know, be judicious with their use of antibiotics. But we need to keep having conversations like this that bring it into the mainstream and kind of, you know, get to the larger topic of things. We need to have more conversations with MDs about how we can have collaborative research and understand, you know, how bugs are moving through the environment. How are they getting from farms to people? And that involves, you know, having discussions between the hospitals and the veterinarians to really make this a true One Health issue, where we're considering the human aspects, the animal aspects, and the environmental aspects all at once, and really keep having those dialogues to keep pushing the field forward.
That's great. Well, thanks again, Matt, for joining us, and we will definitely stay in touch.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate the time.
Thank you for listening. We'll talk to you next month.
Thanks for listening to this month's episode of Superbugs Unplugged. We really appreciate it, and we hope you enjoyed the episode. I'm Laura Rogers, Deputy Director for ARAC. Now that you've listened to us, we'd love to hear from you. Please send any questions you have our way, and we'll do our best to answer them in future episodes. We'd also love to hear your ideas for topics you'd like us to cover in the coming months. You can reach us at superbugsunplugged@gmail.com. And one last thing. If you'd like to help us spread the word, please give us a 5-star review and ask your friends and colleagues to subscribe. We can be found on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and every major listening app. We'll talk to you again next month.